The views expressed on this podcast are only those of the individuals featured on the show and do not in any way reflect the official policy of the United States government.
You are listening to the Embassy Wealth Podcast. We believe wealth isn't just about finances and money. It includes health, relationships, and anything else that makes you excited to get up in the morning. We interview members of the foreign affairs community to see how they're building wealth, both personally and financially, no matter where they're posted. This is your host, Tanya Salseth. Let's get to today's show. Welcome to the Embassy Wealth Podcast. And today we're joined by John Matzner. And John has a very, very interesting story. He was a Govy federal government for 7 years, serving at posts overseas in the Middle East, Tunisia, and Dubai, and left the government in 2017 to start his own entrepreneurial journey. Since then, he has done lots of things, buying, selling businesses, creating businesses. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Tanya.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about government and that leap to being an entrepreneur, because a lot of times people, they're like, well, going and being a government employee is kind of like following the rules, and entrepreneurs are, it's kind of the opposite, right? So how'd you make that leap?
So I think that probably what was most impactful to me was I was pretty much on a trajectory to just be like a normal civilian person my whole life. But in high school, 9/11 happened for me. Mm-hmm. I lived in the Northeast. And so starting from that point, kind of interlacing some mode of government service felt important to me. You know, like I read Stephen Ambrose's Citizen Soldiers, and like, just like this idea that like, you don't have to do government or the military forever in order to like have it be a part of your journey. And so I think for me, the government was actually the time out from the trajectory that I was on versus the other way around. And so I'd always kind of self-identified as, oh yeah, like, of course I'll go into business. I come from a family of business people, like whatever. But then I was kind of fundamentally impacted by
world events.
Yeah, by world events. And I was like, oh, I got to do something. So I went and did that for a little while, and then kind of, I think, reverted to the mean. So for me, it was maybe a little bit different than a lot of people, where I never really, I always knew it was going to be kind of like an interlude rather than kind of like what I do for 35 years or something.
Exactly. Yeah. The full package and the pension and all of that.
Exactly. Yeah.
Interesting. Yep. So you had this interlude for 7 years. How did that influence you as kind of a business owner and entrepreneur? Did it?
Yeah, I think probably the biggest thing that it did, and I wonder if you have this same experience, which was it put me up against a lot of wealthy and powerful people, and it completely removed the sense of mystery around them.
Interesting.
So being around hyper successful people in Africa or the Middle East or South Asia, and just being like, oh, that dude's just like me. Like, you know, like, you know, smoking Marlboro wet reds with some like Pakistani exporter who's worth a gajillion dollars. And I'm like,
he's just a regular dude.
Yeah, it's just a dude.
Yeah, we're just like hanging out on a Friday.
Yeah, yeah. Just, you know, drinking Johnny Walker Blue and, you know, talking about whatever, cricket. Uh-huh. Right. And so I think it removed the mystery of wealth. It removed the mystery of kind of like just commerce. In a way that if I would have just been like a junior person trying to make my way up, thinking that there was this, like, I kind of like got to skip to the top because I was talking to, you know, because
fancy
of that
people.
Diplomatic passport, I was able
That's
to talk
right.
to people that, like, you know, I was like 29 talking to some guy who's, you know, so that's probably what drove a lot of it.
Yeah. I mean, we do have those opportunities, right? Overseas at embassies where you are 29 and all of a sudden you're like, and that's the president of the country. Oh my gosh.
Exactly. Yeah.
And you just get a little starstruck. You're like, okay, right. But how interesting that was what it sort of leveled to the playing field in a way. And it is a lot of this, we create our own story in our head about what is possible. And I think the Foreign Service is a good landscape where anything is possible, kind of, you know? And I think that's really cool that you took that away from your experience with the government. So how did you make that transition? So you just sort of said, okay, this, I'm done. And then what? Did you have something lined up? Did you know what you wanted to do?
I didn't, you know. So I left and I was in Dubai, and where I kind of, you know, I've always been like a little nuts, you know. And
welcome to the club.
Yeah. Right? At that time I was single, kind of unattached. And so, you know, I had some money saved and just was kind of like, I like Dubai. I'm going to stay here.
As one does. Yeah, why not?
Whatever. Like living abroad. And and where I kind of just randomly got hooked into was foreign direct investment into the US. Because specifically because it was very similar, at least a lot of it, to what you do in the Foreign Service, which is meet wealthy people and build their trust in America. And whether that turns into some sort of policy discussion or whether that turns into raising mezzanine debt for a multifamily thing in Florida, that's pretty close. And so that was kind of where I, only for a couple, like maybe a year or two, that was kind of my soft landing spot. And it got me even more exposure. It was kind of like this halfway step, because a lot of the kind of activities were the same, but instead of proponing, you know, US government policy or whatever it happened to be, it was commercial real estate.
Business deals.
And so it got me exposure, and just kind of like over the course of that, I learned digital marketing, which I then parlayed into other stuff. And so I always was just kind of like, the way that I always thought about it since I left the government was like reinventing myself 50% at a time. So I would take the old 50% and swap a new 50% and just try to like use that to piece my way more directionally to where I wanted to go. So that's how I did it.
So it sounds like you were really open to possibilities. You weren't like, I need to do this thing when I leave, and you had it all planned out. You kind of just, it sounds like you were just open to opportunity, and this came up and you were working on commercial deals from Dubai.
Yep.
And then what happened after that? So you said this was sort of the first 50%, right? What happens next?
So over the course of that, and you know, just give like a 10 sentence story about what that was. Historically, that foreign direct investment into the US, particularly for real estate, was dominated by like this old boys network where you
big surprise.
You get a bunch.
Surprise.
Yeah, you exactly. you're exactly right. You get a bunch of accountants and white-shoed law firms in Istanbul, Islamabad, and Mumbai to throw you an event at the Ritz. They invite other clients. You pay them a referral fee, and that's how you raise money in the emerging market. That was just the playbook, right? Mm-hmm. Istanbul, Bodrum, whatever. You go to wealthy people in the emerging market. And I was like, well, I don't want to do that. And so I started running Facebook ads, primarily digital marketing. And kind of reinvented the way that foreign direct investment was raised, because I didn't have access to some of these circles in some of these countries. So I started working with these folks, and through some partners and deals that I did, blasting Facebook ads in South Africa and Islamabad and Mumbai, and going direct to consumers instead of intermediated by the white-shoed law firm in—
That is wild.
Yeah. So so over the course of that, I was able to accumulate a bunch of experience in marketing, sales, obviously, and then realized that I wanted to actually own and operate businesses, not just raise money for them.
Right.
Because I wasn't really that excited by raising, you know,
capital.
Yeah, capital.
It's kind just of like, once you've done it, you've done it, and you're like,
okay. It's just like not my thing. But I was able to, again, accumulate like a bunch of skills. As a random aside, my model ended up really kind of transforming a lot of this because of COVID, because they couldn't travel anymore. So they all had to use this kind of methodology that we developed, this direct to consumer, foreign direct investment stuff, which is pretty cool.
Fascinating.
Yeah. And just, you know, just like figuring it out. So, I just decided that I wanted to operate. And so, I started, buying businesses, with foreign capital. And so, because I already had those relationships.
What kind of businesses? Curious.
The first couple I bought were not very good, were some stuff in the automotive space in Florida.
Are you partnering with these foreign investors so that they have like a US boots on the ground person? Is that the idea?
Yep. Or that was at least the original thing, which is there's a lot of flight capital that wants a home in the US.
Yeah.
Right.
Capital chasing return.
Yep. And they also for preservation, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're Pakistani, you're like, I don't want my money sitting here. I want it in US dollars in something
stable and more secure.
Nationalized. Right. And so there was always an appetite for that. And I used kind of some of my relationships and methodologies that I developed raising money for other people to kind of raise money for my own deals. And then bought a couple, learned a lot about kind of operating businesses, stuff like that. And then since that time, just kind of kept that trend going. But that was the kind of three or four
segue steps into.
Yeah, that was kind of like the three or four steps into kind of more interesting stuff.
Huh. So you go from government employee to helping foreign investors to now owning your own businesses, right? So what kind of businesses do you own?
So a bunch now. And I've always just kind of enjoyed that. I've always liked having a couple different things going on. So I think where I've always been directed has been trying to, much like a strategy that I'm sure you're familiar with in real estate, is I like the equivalent in businesses of fixer-uppers. So not really like flipping them, but I guess it would be add value would be another way to say it, which is you come in and you're like, okay, this is a great business, but it needs a lot of work. Yep. It needs to be modernized. It needs to be some technology needs to be evolved, some modern marketing, stuff like that. And so probably my most successful acquisition to date was a company that I bought in Southern California that did, it was in the home improvement space. Was doing maybe $1 million a year in sales, bought it for not a ton of money, and then was able, at this point, we've now, via kind of a method that we created, we're in 20 states, 20 locations.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Talk to us more about that. How does that happen?
3 years. Yeah. Uh-huh. So pretty cool.
Congrats.
Thank you.
This home improvement business in Southern California. So talk to us about how you acquired it and why there and details, please.
Yeah, of course. So I wanted to buy a business in a place I wanted to live. So I wanted to move to San Diego, which is where I live. And so started just looking kind of both on market and off market for business acquisition opportunities, and was industry agnostic. So looked at a ton of different stuff. I looked at a courier business. I looked at a party rental business. I looked at basically everything but restaurants, because I'm not a masochist. And so essentially looking for stuff that I wanted to buy, and stumbled across a business that I thought had the bones of something I could really do something with, which ended up being this home improvement business. And so bought it with a little bit of cash, big chunk of seller financing, and kind of came in and ran it. And started with a very small kind of fire, let's say, and just professionalized it and worked hard and changed the way it's marketed, the way we deliver our products, stuff like that. I eventually, after about 2 years, I sold that business, but was able to kind of retain the rights to the business system, which I now license. So we have these kind of licensees in these 20 states now, and there's a whole reason I did that. But so that's an example.
So here's a question for you. Sure. How many hours a week do you work on your respective businesses? Are you sort of a absentee owner? Do you remotely operate? Do you actually go into any of the businesses that you own?
Yep. So that one in particular, I was in every stinking day. I mean, that was a living, breathing, failing.
Are you like swinging the hammer and doing the home improvement at all?
No. So I don't, you know, have you ever bought a business?
I have a franchise.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Yeah. So this thing that I'm doing is actually a competitor to a franchise. And I can tell you a little bit about that.
Ooh.
For a while we were marketing it as an anti-franchise, which is
interesting.
Which we can talk about. But so you know a little bit about business acquisition, business systems, right? So what I would say was we bought this and I was able to pretty much work on the business from day one. And that was things like systemization, business processes, marketing, sales improvements, technology, stuff like that. I wasn't actually like in the field, so to speak. I was sitting in an office, writing things, creating things, signing up providers, things like that.
So you're kind of like an efficiency consultant in a way. So you go in, you buy a business that, you know, is doing well, right? And then you take a look at all of the different facets of it and be like, how can we make this better? So if we can kick the, you know, 1982 fax machine out of there, or, oh my God, you're still using index cards for your, you know, system. So you modernize and use technology, it sounds like, to streamline and bring the business into 2023.
Among other things, absolutely. Yes.
Among other things. Okay.
Well, meaning it's not just technology. It's
right, a
bunch of other stuff too, right? It's, it's changing the way salespeople are compensated. It's adding additional marketing channels. It's creating a professional referral program, right? It's, so some of it is adding technology, but some of it is just businessing. You know, oh, are we charging enough? Should we stop selling that product? Should we introduce this product? You know, it's just normal all-purpose businessing.
I like how you say normal, because I think, you know, a lot of our listeners are still in federal government, right? And they're thinking, how on earth would I go in and do anything like that? Did you take a course? Did you just Google a bunch of stuff? It sounds like, because I mean, it wasn't like you were running a home improvement business before and you were just like, hey, I'm going to buy that and I'm going to do all of these things. Where did you find sort of the expertise or the know-how to work on all these bits? Because, you know, I think one of the challenges of being a business owner is you wear many hats, right? And some of them you're better at and some of them you're not. Like, tech is not my favorite piece of the business. I like to farm that piece out. Sales and marketing, I love, right? So how did you sort of come in as a business owner and decide, okay, I'm working on these things? And again, you're one person, right? So it's very hard to make those kinds of big changes to an organization, especially one that's been running a certain way.
Yep.
How do you come into, you know, like a specific culture that has been created around a small business and completely revamp it? I think that's it's a pretty tall order. You make it sound easy in like 2 minutes, right? But
no, it is. And to be clear, I worked my little booty off, right?
Right.
And there was a lot of risk and a lot of drunk employees and frivolous lawsuits.
There's some real hairy stuff you deal with as a business owner.
Right. And so you lived in France, so I can make a highbrow reference. I think it's a lot like kind of my belief about like existentialism, which is the only way out is through it. So you face the reality and you keep going. Right. Yeah. And so you don't deny it. So with small business and small business acquisitions, you're like, oh, it's a complete kick in the face, but it's totally worth it.
It totally is. I say that. Yeah. I say that all the time.
Right. So you come out, but the idea is you don't say, oh, no, it's easy. You're like, no, it's going to be probably the hardest thing you've ever done, but it's totally worth it. Right.
Yeah. So it's like being punched in the face and getting up the next morning and doing it all over again.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, pain tolerance, right. I heard a great quote. It said, small businesses are loosely functioning disasters that occasionally make money, which is a wonderful description of small business ownership.
Truth.
Right. And so I think broadly speaking,
it is.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so I think strangely, you know, I was really impatient to go overseas. And so I did Arabic and was able to like test really well and did it mostly like on my own. And I think a lot of those muscles that I developed turned me into like a little baby autodidact, which is just like super energetic to like study and learn really fast. And I did that originally because I wanted to get abroad. But then the same thing to saying like, all right, what do I need to know about reading a balance sheet and a P&L? And I would just like consume a bunch of information. I was like, okay, now to put it to work. And so I think you just go to school and you just read, consume, talk to people, talk to old guys, old girls who've been there, done that. And so I think you just improvise, adapt, and overcome. And that's kind of what I did.
And I think a lot of the skills that served you well in government service, right? Like going into a room where like you don't know anybody, it's a totally different culture and you have to instantly create rapport with someone who has really a very different life experience than you do is an incredibly valuable skill.
Oh yeah.
Incredibly valuable. And I think I often hear FSOs talk to me and say, well, you know, I don't know if I can transfer skills to the private sector. I'm like, what are you talking about? That is an incredibly valuable skill that you can use in almost any business situation, right?
So what I would say, and I wrote a post about this on, I'm pretty active on Twitter. It's where like a lot of people find out about me or read about me. And I wrote this and it's often common. It's common with FSOs, common with military folks, which is the way that I think about it is like your time in the government is your 80% base. And that prepares you for things that are very similar to your old government role, meaning like a government relations thing, or if you're in the military, like a security gig. Then you can pick up maybe another 10% through like formal education, like an MBA or something like that. But that last 10%, you have to develop a hard skill set because you can't like network your way to running a small business.
No.
But you can use your really good soft skills, which is what your FSO career was. But then you need to learn a local real estate market or you need to learn digital marketing. And so what your government time, whether it's military or foreign service or whatever it is a really good like starting point of soft skills. But then you need to go to school to to bring it to a point so that you can make money, which is, again, learning commercial real estate, learning how to raise money, whatever it is. And so for people listening who are like, well, I don't know anything about running a small business, you're like, no, you don't, but you're 80% of the way there, soft skills. Now just put in a little bit of time, effort, sweat to just bring it to a point, and now you're a machine. Now you're an all-star because you get to use all those old soft skills and combine it with a little bit of business specific skills, and now you're an absolute monster. That's kind of how I've always thought about it.
100%. I couldn't agree more, because I mean, you take the base and then you work with it and then you just sharpen the point, if you will.
Correct.
Based on, and again, most of our foreign service colleagues, I mean, they've studied a lot. It's, you know, they're self-taught. They read a lot of books. I mean, this is totally figure outable, right? I mean, it's obviously it's different industries and stuff, but like you said, you were industry agnostic because you have the skill to immediately put yourself in a situation, learn what you need to do and work on the fly, which is what we're always asked to do in the foreign service, right?
Exactly. And I think the mistake, and I don't know if it's quite as common in the foreign service, but in the military context, I think where a lot of people mess up oftentimes is they think that 80% is sufficient and they have an expectation.
Fair.
Like,
yeah,
I'm an expert in logistics. It's like, no, you're not. You're an expert in DOS logistics.
Correct.
Very different than an expert in Amazon like,
right.
So like, go back in with a beginner's mind, be willing to humble yourself and say, look, I know logistics in a government context, but I need to bring it to a point in order to be applicable in a private sector. So I think it's simultaneously very good news and bad news. Mm-hmm. The bad news is that you're worthless. The good news is very quickly you can bring it to a point and be the best person in the room. So that's like, that was the story I told myself. Whether that was correct or incorrect, it served
me. Worked for you. Yeah, exactly. It worked for you.
It might not be right.
So your current situation now is that you're always, it seems to me that you're looking for businesses to buy and kind of rehab, if you will, to use that fixer-upper analogy, and then resell at a profit and then kind of like turn that money and make more through flipping businesses, kind of? Is that sort of your...
I like holding them more than flipping them, actually.
Okay,
so fair. Broadly speaking, I'm a kind of buy, upgrade, and hold.
Mm.
And what always interested me, you know, and there's advantages and disadvantages, real estate, business acquisitions, whatever. What I always liked more about businesses was the ability to generate cash rapidly is unparalleled. So if you get a 15 or 20% IRR in real estate, you're in heaven. I try to double or triple up businesses every 6 months when I buy them, which is like in real estate, that's unheard of, but in small business, it's extremely doable.
Unheard of.
Yeah. It's like, that doesn't happen. 15% IRR
or
whatever it is. Yeah.
And how do you do that? Is it just making those big changes within the structure of the business to increase efficiencies and in terms of like human productivity and then just also sort of like tech and the systems and processes or like, because that's a pretty, you know, big goal, even just for a business that's already functioning, right? Like doubling or tripling income within a short period of time.
Yep. So I'll give you a specific example with this home improvement business, right? We bought it and it had like, you know, two crews. The owner did all the sales and was spending maybe $2,000 a month on marketing. And they did about $100,000 a month, roughly. So what I started doing was systematically going through the business and unblocking why we weren't growing. So the first thing we did was we figured out how to have people other than the previous owner sell. Because if you only have one person selling.
One salesperson, yeah.
Exactly. So the first thing we did was I sat down with him and we figured out how to sell the stuff. And I hired a bunch of commission-only salespeople. Okay. Then the next thing was, how do we have more crews? So we did the same thing with crews. Then we said, well, we don't have enough leads. Then we said, okay, how do we spend more on marketing? And so systematically working through the business and saying, what's the blocker to growth?
Mm.
And then just working that problem until you unlock growth. And so at its peak before I sold it, you know, we went from maybe $2,000 a month on marketing. We were probably up near $50,000, $60,000 a month in marketing.
Woo!
Because we'd increased our capacity.
Yes.
So that I had 12 salespeople, I had 7 crews, I had a system to operationally deliver on all the promises we were keeping. But that was just a series of, okay, what's stopping us now? Not enough leads. What's stopping us now? Not enough salespeople. What's stopping us now? Not enough cash. And you just kind of work your way through the business, untying knots in, you know, nothing that innovative, but just kind of
removing
like
roadblocks.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Removing roadblocks. It's like, why don't we have more leads? Okay, because Yelp is really bad to advertise. Okay, where else can we go? Okay, we can go to Google. Great, I need a Google guy. Great, how do I pay the Google guy? Great. And you just work your way through the business systematically and just kind of remove those roadblocks.
Awesome. I mean, it sounds like you grew the business really fast. Why did you decide to sell?
Home improvement is a really easy business to run at a certain, most businesses have a certain size they want to be. Mm-hmm. And when you're talking about a business to consumer, B2C business in home improvement, it has some very natural caps. For example, geographic coverage from a warehouse, right? If I sell you a piece of software, I can sell it to you anywhere in the world and keep my promises. We were based in San Diego, and if we make a sale in Malibu, I have to pay $400 in overtime just to get my crew there.
Yeah.
Right. And so it becomes uneconomic to grow beyond a certain size unless you change your business model. Mm-hmm. And so what we did was we sold our brick and mortar one because those businesses are, I'm going to say air quotes, really easy, again, air quotes, to get to $1 million or $2 million a year. But beyond that, they become much more difficult. Mm. And so what we decided to do was this kind of, we call it an affiliate model, which has got some similarities with the franchise, but it allows us to grow nationally very rapidly because we don't have those same kind of constraints.
And this leads us to our next point. You were talking about anti-franchise. It sounds like what you're doing is sort of taking your model and selling your model. So how is that not a franchise?
Yeah. So franchises, largely speaking, are regulated at the state level, although there are some national regulations as well. And primarily, again, not in every state, particularly New York and Florida, but put those to the side for now, have a three-part franchise test, all three parts of which must be true in order to be a franchise. And the first one that we is the reason why we're not a franchise is we don't share a common brand name. And so what we say is that we sell the engine in the car, not the paint on the car. So we teach you how to run a wonderful garage upgrade company, but they're all not called the same things. They have no common branding, no common products. Mm-hmm. And so you can learn how to run this home improvement company, but it's your name. It'd be called Tanya's Home Improvement Company, not John's Home Improvement Company Florida location.
I don't know if I would hire a company that sounded like that, but okay. But I get what you're saying.
So the point, broadly speaking, is what we saw was not in every industry, in some industries, a local brand is more powerful than a national brand.
Fair, yeah.
And mm-hmm. so, for example, in home improvement, people would rather work with Denver Home Improvement than Nationwide Home Improvement. And right. so what we did was we kind of sold the engine or, you know, kind of the piping underneath, mm-hmm. but then the wrapper around it is completely separate. And that keeps us kind of well wide of, in everywhere but New York, well wide of franchise regulations.
Fascinating. So if people purchase this anti-franchise, if you will, I don't know what you call it.
We call them affiliates.
But affiliates. Okay. So what does that buy them? Is it similar to a franchise model where there's an upfront fee and then there's like royalties, or do they just, it's like one and done and they don't get any support afterwards? Like, how does your model work? I'm curious.
Yep. So it's three parts. It's a kind of upfront data dump, which is kind of online. And it's like this huge encyclopedia of how to run one of these. Everything from what Facebook ads to run to sales contracts to who the manufacturers are, right? Then there's a bunch of optional shared services. So that's another way that we sell, stay well wide of franchise stuff is it's optional. So like you don't have to buy anything from us, but if you want to, you can use our software. And then the third is a ongoing support and community. So we have just a whole community of, hey, does anybody-
Like a subscription or something?
Yeah. Yep. And so all of our folks are on kind of weekly, bi-weekly calls talking about what challenges they're having. I've got a whole team that kind of supports folks in being successful. So
fascinating.
Yeah.
And you know, I think one thing that we haven't talked about is it sounds like what you've really mastered as a business owner is finding people to delegate work to, which is, I think, one of the hardest things for small business owners to actually do because they get very passionate and they get in their thing and they're down in the weeds, like swinging the hammer. Mm. And it sounds like you just avoided all of that. Like you went in, you got the details, right? So you got into the home improvement business, you worked a ton of hours, you figured out all the little bits and pieces of the system, but then you actually stepped back and you let other people do it. How has that been in terms of hiring, firing? Because it sounds like, you know, you basically delegate and outsource as much as you possibly can. So you can have the lifestyle that you do, which is, by the way, he is joining us from Paris, people, on vacation, just FYI. So how does that piece work for you? Because I think this is one of the choke points in why businesses don't get bigger, why business owners don't grow, is because they're unwilling to turn over parts of their business. They get very possessive and they're like, only I can do it. And I don't trust people, or they, you know, run through a bunch of people and they're like, well, that person didn't work, that person didn't work. And really the problem is them. It's not the people or the system. There's no system for employees to follow. It sounds like you've been very, very successful in, you know, kind of cracking this nut early on and making sure that the right people have the right jobs and the right processes. Talk to us a little bit more about how you actually did that.
Sure. So I think for me, it's all stemmed from the kind of life that I want to create. And so I worked backwards from there. And what I came to appreciate over time through studying and learning in my own experiences, which is, there's this great quote, and I think it's, I'll butcher it, but it's from the head of Honda or Hyundai or whatever. And he said, you get mediocre results because of excellent people working in a bad system.
System. Yep.
And we get excellent results from mediocre people working in an excellent system. Meaning, I can take an average person and have them produce excellently because I have an excellent system. And so what I've really gone to school with, or gone to school for, and I help a lot of business owners now, and I do some like advisory stuff, and this is a lot of what I write a newsletter about this topic, is this idea of, if you, the business owner, can't step away from the business and it doesn't keep functioning, you don't have a business, you have a job.
100%.
And so building systems that can predictably deliver and sell the goods you produce, absent from the individual efforts of the owner, is what you do as a business owner. That is what you should be doing. Rather than delivering the products, and there's phases, right? So phase one is the owner delivers the product themselves. Phase two is the owner directly supervises the work delivered. Phase three, right? And so you kind of work your way up this hierarchy in order to kind of maintain the quality of your product or service, but allow you to get greater and greater leverage on your time, greater and greater leverage on your money. And eventually, if you're thinking about actually creating real enterprise value is extremely tied to how distant the owner can be from the operations of the company. Because if the whole thing shuts down, if John quits, well, then nobody's going to buy it, because why?
They can't buy you. You're not for sale.
Unless they hire you as an employee, and that's what an earnout is, right? So however, if you say, oh, John, he doesn't do anything, he just does some deals every now and then, you've created real enterprise value, real company value, that somebody else can swoop in and say, oh yeah, everything's written down, there's a system, there's a process, there's a management team, there's accountability, there's KPIs. And that's a really wonderful way to create value in a business where none existed before.
Fascinating. I could ask so many questions, but you know, maybe one or two more. I'm curious because, you know, as a business owner, I find that the business grows to the extent you do, right? As your own self and your own personal, you know, sure, world and perspective. What challenges have you faced running into, you know, business and doing all of these things? What are some of the things that you've had to overcome as a person? Like, sure. Because for example, like, me as a business owner, I have a certain relationship with money, right? And so there was a point where I'm like, I really need to spend on stuff. And it was very hard for me to do so, right? We run into these roadblocks of where our own personal development inhibits our growth path. And it sounds like your growth path has been pretty wide open and you don't have these hangups. Has there been something that was really challenging for you, and how'd you overcome it?
Yeah, tons. You know, I'm like a lightly functioning disaster on a week to week basis. What I will say, I heard this line. I heard this line that always empowered me, that I always told myself, which was, be yourself, and if that doesn't work, be somebody else. And I heard that very early in my career. And what it always challenged me to do was to ask myself, what does the business need me to be right now? And so my natural tendency is, I like kind of more salesy type stuff, business developy type stuff. And completely randomly, since over the last couple of years, I've been known as like a process engineer or an operations guy.
And I could see that. Yeah.
The only reason is because that's what the business needed me. The business didn't need a sales guy. The business needed somebody who was a process creator. And so I said, all right, I can either sit here and not have the business thrive, or I can do what it takes for the business to get to the next level. And so I think it's a lot of like the Carol Dweck growth mindset stuff, right? Which is if you just like sit there and cross your arms and you're like, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
I don't do details or whatever. You're like, all right, great. Then don't do details and build a business that you can't sell one day.
Yeah.
And so I think having this kind of like Carol Dweck growth mindset thing of just like, yeah, I'm an ops person. I just haven't learned it yet.
Fair.
Or I'm a salesperson. I just haven't learned it yet. Or I'm a numbers guy. I just haven't learned it yet. So I would say operations more broadly was something that does not come naturally to me, but it was what the companies that I was running needed. So I'm like, I guess I'm an operations guy. And just go to work, right? I mean, I struggled studying Spanish in high school because I thought I was bad at languages.
But you learned Arabic. What?
Hello? It was because I learned to like rejigger my brain to say like, you're not good or bad at languages. You just haven't hammered your flashcards enough. Right. And so, or whatever it happens to be. Right. So I think for me, it was like this, you're totally right, which is it's like an inner game thing. If you sit around and you just say, well, I'm a consular officer, so I don't do outgoing stuff. I like details. It's like, okay, then be
like, I'm an introvert and I don't like mixing at party or whatever it is. Yes.
Or you know, real estate. Oh, I'm a real estate agent. I don't do details. Great. Then just be a commission guy the rest of your life.
Right. Fine.
Or do you want to be a business owner? And so I always try to challenge myself to just like become what was needed for me to get to the next level. Do I need to be stuffy? Do I need to be corporate? Do I need to be a swashbuckler? Do I need to be an ops guy? And just have a very kind of amorphous sense of self to just
say, you're a chameleon is what you
are. I'm a guy who gets the job done.
Mm-hmm.
And that just always, again, these are all stories I tell myself. It's probably all bullshit, but it serves me well because I'm like, I just haven't learned it yet, you know?
And I think that's really, really important. And a point that I can't hammer home enough for people is if you say the words I am and what comes after it, whatever you say is going to be true. And think about what you're telling yourself right now, the story you were telling yourself about, well, I'm not good at X. Are you really? Is that really true? Probably not. It's just because you haven't done anything or haven't learned anything or haven't spent any time actually looking at whatever X is, right? I'm this, I'm that. You have to be careful what words follow that sentence construction because you make your world through your words. And I love what John is saying because he decided that he wasn't going to limit himself by saying, well, I'm this, and then just staying stuck there. He was like, well, I need to do X thing to become good at this. And I can be good at this if I do the work, right? Which is, I think is such a huge, huge and powerful thing to do. So very, very nice. And
it's,
I guess
it's weird because it slips a little bit into like, I have a real love-hate relationship with like motivational speakers.
They're cheesy sometimes, yes.
If somebody was to just clip like the last 45 seconds of this, you'd think it was just like two people. Oh, and it's about, and it's like, on one hand, I'm like, yeah, it's kind of bullshit. But on the other hand, I'm like, it's the only thing that matters. And so I'm kind of two minds, which is like hippy dippy motivational speaker. And also like, I don't have time for that. And so just like balancing those two like competing ideas, which is like, believe in, and you can teach, and it's about your self-talk. And I'm just like, oh.
Oh, I know. We hear it so much and it's like so cheesy and like, correct. Oh, such baloney.
Correct. Correct. But
there's some truth to it. There's
but at the same time, if you don't do that and you just believe you're an X or a Y, yeah. So it's, I have a real love hate relationship with like that, you know, like some Instagram quote or something, you know, so.
Completely. And so to wrap up, I'm curious, John, what's next for you? You've done a lot of really amazing things since leaving government. I mean, you're in Paris living the high life right now, running your businesses remotely. And, you know, you've got employees all over the world. What's next?
So the big thing that I'm excited about these days, and it was thanks to my kind of government service, and it's been a tool that I've used forever, is I am really, really excited about helping American companies use global talent. And meaning, in every company that I've ever owned, I have not been limited to employees that were within 30 minutes of the office. I have had operations managers in India, and I've had people answering the phone in South Africa, and I've had British accountants, and I've had whatever, right? And I think because of my exposure to different cultures in my government career, when I entered the private sector, I was just like, why would I ever have my books done here when I've got somebody great who's awesome in this country that can do it, right? And so I've spent a lot of the last couple of years working with American businesses to globalize their workforce. And I think I'm in the process of starting a company now, and will continue to do just this kind of globalization of American companies' workforces in a meaningful way, because I feel very comfortable kind of in the international context. And I've just seen how much it's helped my companies grow, be of better service to their customers, kind of, et cetera. And I've seen these wonderful, wonderful, incredible people who work globally for American companies who are just absolute all-stars. And so that's probably what's next for me, is continue to work on that.
Awesome. You know, it's like you said, you're constantly reinventing yourself, right? And you are a bit of a chameleon. You can be what you need to be for the, what the situation calls for, which I think is actually a skill you can practice a lot in the Foreign Service. But John, thanks so much for being on the show. I think it was a really great interview. And it just goes to show that there are some amazing things you can do post-government service, right? John is a living, breathing example of that. So thanks so much for taking time to be on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Tanya.
If you like this episode and want more, make sure to give us 5 stars on the podcast player of your choice. And after that, check out our Facebook page. From there, you can learn about our other episodes, connect with our guests, and of course, share your own ideas for success. We'll see you next time.